A Curragh classic, Cheltenham changes and Chester chaos. This is the front page. Hello there and welcome along to this week's edition of The Front Page. I'm your host, Maddie Pleyle, for today's show. I'm joined by Matt Rennie and Liam Head on the sofa beside me, and we have a wonderful show in store for you. First up, let's talk about the action at the Curragh. We had a classic in the Irish Oaks, and it was won in sensational style by Johanna Walsh. She reversed the Ribblesdale form with earth shots. Joseph O'Brien, Dylan Bram at Monaghan, just a team at the peak of their powers, gents. Matt, were you surprised by the manner in which she did this?
Yes. Yeah, I was. It was a classic performance in the classic, really, fitting for the race. More surprised she was able to turn it around so brilliantly. And now I'm left wondering which one's the best filly that Joseph O'Brien's got. Because obviously we didn't see Thundering On. She was an absentee on the morning of the race off her feed. And the Oaks form has taken an absolute another hammer blow in the Irish Oaks. Amelia Earhart, again, really, really disappointing. We've seen Legacy Link was comprehensively beaten in the Ribblesdale Stakes, but wasn't expecting Johanna Walsh to turn it around as she did. But crikey, it was a good old performance. And I think it's more about the horse. I don't know whether it would be the strongest of Irish Oaks we've ever seen, but the trainer himself, I know Tom Siegel spoke glowingly about him at Royal Ascot. The amount of superlatives he can't really be described for Joseph O'Brien, given he's probably the best trainer, well, he's the best dual-purpose trainer I think we've seen for very much a long time now. The fact he can win classics on the level and then just churn out Cheltenham Festival winners as well every year. It's pretty staggering, given, you know, we know about what his dad's done, completely different conversation, but what he can do over both codes. And he's got significant backing, but he hasn't got Coolmore behind it.
No.
He's doing this. It's pretty remarkable. And yeah, it's all about the trainer, I thought, for that one. I can't get over how good of a trainer he is at the moment.
Yeah, it just keeps going from strength to strength for him. And Dylan Bram at Monaghan always had the horse in the perfect position. It was a kind of a funny paced race in many ways, but I just think he looks so composed, so confident, Liam. Do you think he's a shoehorn in for that Ballydoyle job when Mr. R.L. Moore departs?
Well, he's certainly making a strong case for it, isn't he? I mean, you know, as Matt touched on, you know, you talk about how good of a training performance it was. And we probably thought that Joseph O'Brien would win the race at the weekend, but obviously everyone was thinking it'd be the other horse thundering on. She obviously didn't take a chance. And this horse was well backed after Thundering On was taken out. But Dylan Bram McMonagall, sorry. I mean, it's just fantastic. I mean, he had a great time of things in Hong Kong, didn't he?
He did so well.
And then he had that injury and he was out for a while. And you know, sometimes it takes you a while to sort of get back to, you know, the levels that you've been showing, you know, earlier in the year and things like that. But he just hit the ground running. And now to have two classics behind him in both Oaks, he's certainly making a case for being the number one somewhere else in the future, that's for sure.
Yeah, the filly, we should talk about her. She's still pretty unexposed, not had many starts. To gap the field like she did, I'm with you, Matt. I'm not sure the form was necessarily the strongest, but it was still an incredible effort. Innes Moore, Sparren Nua, filling the places. Did anything catch your eye in behind?
Innes Moore did. I feel really sorry for David Winisi anyway, because I remember Tam Farna was so unlucky in the 1,000 Guineas those years ago. And Innes Moore, I don't think she'd have won on Saturday, but she could have been a lot closer. And then we're going, oh, he's so unlucky again. So he's been knocking at the door with the fillies owned by Quantum Leaf as well, both of them, that have gone for that sort of that classic success. It makes me feel that Manise might stumble upon one in the future and all of a sudden just land on the classic. I do as well. I think he's a brilliant trainer. But apart from that, I'm more fascinated to see what Joseph does next with both fillies. I know he said he wasn't averse to both of them taking each other on. I mean, could we
Whose camp would you be in?
I don't know. It's hard to tell. I've always been a massive Thundering On fan after Epsom, and I think I thought at the time she'd run a huge race in the Arc. Now the form's been such dented, so bad as it has, sort of umming and ahhing a bit. But maybe she's also just wants giving the ground as well. I hope they both go to the Yorkshire Oaks, but that's just biased me saying it. I mean, there's so many options for them. The Lopper at the end of the season, one might go there instead of going for the Arc. But it's a nice headache for Mr. O'Brien to have.
On Innes Moore, I wonder if they'll go back down in trip with her. I think maybe 10 could be her optimum. Yorkshire Oaks, they're thinking for the winner. I would side with Thundering On, I think, in a rematch, just because of that star quality she showed at Epsom. But you are having to forgive that Pretty Polly run. But for me, she looked like she was going to bolt up in that race. And then she did have a legitimate excuse when she was found to be coughing afterwards. Kind of surprised they didn't make more of that. Look, obviously things haven't gone to plan because she's now missed a key engagement. But I just think you can't forget the impression she gave when she won the Oaks. I haven't seen a horse win like that in a long time.
Yeah, but I was also taken aback by how well Joanna Walsh won that. Like you said, after the Ascot run, you know, to come back like that, and I'd be surprised. I know they were obviously due to both run against each other the other day, and it didn't happen for the reason we mentioned. But I think that Joseph, now that they've both confirmed the promise of, you know, classic winners and so on, that he'll try and keep them apart if he can.
It would be logical, wouldn't it?
Yeah, like you've got two superstars on your hands, and you don't want to sort of use all your sort of darts on one go kind of thing. So I was really impressed with that yesterday. I mean, once Thundering On was taken out of the race, it was just, you could have made a case for a lot of the other representatives in the race. I was very impressed with Inishmore. I think I know Devon Menizier was very sort of bullish about her sort of future. He said the world's her oyster when he was speaking to the Racing Post the other day. And I think she's got a very bright future. But yeah, it'd be interesting to see what they do. I mean, out of the two of them, I mean, I must say I was probably more visually impressed with what I seen with Joanna Walsh yesterday.
Wow.
Than Thundering On in the Oaks.
Okay. Did Earthshot get O'Brien'd, do we think? Would we give her another chance? I just thought she wasn't travelling well enough to make the move when she needed to, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. And I didn't think she travelled brilliantly at Ascot either, but she did very, very well to come where she's from. And then I there's the loose horse that was in the Ribblesdale and whatnot, but I just think maybe she's not up to that level.
Okay. I was really taken by Celeron's performance in the Railway Stakes. Break Slowly was a bit unlucky at Royal Ascot, but made up for that winning there. Some other notable performances, notable news. We had Maltese Cross last week win the Grand Prix de Paris. Didn't get very much luck in running, but still managed to win for Tom Marquand and William Haggis. He looks a really promising horse. St. Ledger or Ark? Let us know in the comments what you would do, and indeed of the rest of our talking points. Constitution Hill, we'll never stop talking about him, will we? Hopefully we're going to see him reappear at Windsor. But let's move on to our second major talking point, which was that Cheltenham are making several changes to the starting procedures after a farce at last year's festival. For the last couple of years, there's been so many problems at the head of these major events. So the main changes are they're making configuration changes, particularly to the 2 mile and 2.5 mile start. You'll remember Paul Nichols was one of the trainers particularly outraged ahead of the Turner's Novices Hurdle. His No Drama This End was plainly disadvantaged there. Greater clarity for jockeys and more flexibility for starters within the rules. They're also creating a new start zone, and this is not just for Cheltenham, this is for all races, whereby races can be started. They're creating a very highly visible zone, they've called it. Similar to the whip rules, they're creating a tiered penalty structure regarding class one and class two races. So for any misdemeanours, that will be amplified in the particularly big contests. And also, and I think this is probably one of the most interesting things they're doing about the starts, is they're making a live audio recording feed directly straight back into the stewards' room. So you'll remember at the start of one of the Cheltenham Festival races, we had that altercation between Nico de Boinville and Declan Queely at this year's Cheltenham Festival. Great, the stewards are going to have better access ultimately to the goings on down at the starts. Liam, you've always a big Cheltenham fan, obviously follow the meeting as closely as we all do. What did you make of these new rules coming in?
Well, me and Matt were actually talking before we came on. I think there's two that certainly stand out for us, and Matt will probably say the same, but it was the audio going back to the stewards.
Yeah.
I think that's crucial because that gives the stewards both replays and, you know, the audio they need to sort of to support any issues go on. And I think that's important because so many different things go on at such a crucial part. You know, everyone's wanting to try and get that little bit of advantage before the race goes off. So I think that's a sort of a big plus. And as well, it gives us as reporters, journalists, punters even, an opportunity to really understand what sort of is going through a jockey's mind before a big race as well. So that's one of the big points. The other thing is the fines. I think jockeys, they know what they're doing. I think a lot of them, they'll try and you know, as you will, you try and gain as much advantage as you can without, you know, officially going over the rules and getting punished. So I think these fines might make jockeys think twice about where they're positioning the horses. But I do think that, listen, this is a situation that needed to be addressed. I think last year was kind of like the final nail in the coffin almost. I mean, I was reading the story when it broke, and it said how this year's Cheltenham Festival, 40% of the races were affected by false starts, which is remarkable when you think there's what, 4 days of racing, seven races a day. And I think that was up from 18% 5 years ago. So
something's changed.
Something has to change. I mean, the difference between that is worrying. And it leaves people with kind of the talking point. We're more talking about the false starts than the actual racing as well. So I think something had to be done. Whether this is the sort of the solution, only time will tell.
Yeah, we should say that this has been a collaborative approach between jockeys, trainers, officials, everyone. Sounds like it's been done in the right way. I'm glad it's been implemented straight away, Matt. We know in British racing, sometimes we end up tearing our hair out waiting for things to change. This is a good example of them being proactive. I guess my main concern is going to be addressed, hopefully, in that when you have starts on a bend or around the chute, it's that age-old thing of the guys around the outside have got to go quicker than the guys on the inside to create a level start and give themselves the best chance. The one thing I hate is the standing starts after a few false attempts, because when you've got horses who are really energised, jockeys who are wanting the best position, you know, we see it time and time again with those close-up shots, don't we? If one horse has got their bum to the tape, one's turning round. I just think it's impossible to get a fair start in that condition. I'd much rather them turn around, walk back and either jig-jog or walk in. But that's just my personal opinion. Do you think this has got all the ingredients to be successful, rather?
I don't know, to be honest with you. I'm less hopeful than others are, purely because it's now up to the jockeys and the starters, so the people, you know, the actual physical people now during the race, almost essentially saying to them, and it's all about Cheltenham, this. It's not, I know a lot of the sort of the rules are across British racing, but the only place where we ever see this issue, the Grand National's got its own sort of starting procedures anyway, where we saw the issues, it's Cheltenham Festival. We don't see it at the November meeting, the Cup meeting.
Exactly, yeah.
So you got to just tell them, just behave yourself. Look at it, way, guys, guys and girls. Just please, I know it's like your cup final, but it's like a manager before the cup finals, which were in the World Cup finals. I'm sure Argentina's manager should have told them to behave themselves a bit more, and they wouldn't have had a set off, would they?
So definitely,
it's about that. Just reining it in, and without the pun really being excused, but reining it in a little bit. I'm fascinated to know about these configurations, because I was talking about you start quite quickly. You're jumping down that two mile five chute. You're jumping your hurdles and fences really quickly. So how are they going to configure it? Because it's obviously quite a... It was a round bend swinging in. I don't know whether they start sort of almost on like a sort of a dog leg in a way, because it might have some straightness in it there. But same with the 2 mile one. If you do it significantly, they could become one mile seven races, maybe. I'm sure the configurations will sort it out, and they'll get the distances spot on. But yeah, as Liam said, I'm a fan of the penalties. I'm not a fan of the penalties for the use of the whip, but actually for the starts, I think it'd work as a really strong deterrent, especially because no race at Cheltenham is under class two. So if they get you banned at the start, you're going to be getting your harsh penalty no matter what. And it could affect the Grand National meeting or the Irish Grand National meeting in the weeks to come. So, yeah, it's a waiting game, essentially. Let's see how the jockeys do it come March next year. But they've got a bit of time to put that into practice beforehand, anyway.
Yeah, I was at Kempton after the festival last year, and I was tasked with asking the jockeys about the false starts. And one of the sort of talking points that kept coming up is that back in the day, maybe 20 years ago, a lot of the senior riders would have a real sort of air of esteem about them, and they would be able to kind of, not necessarily school, but influence the younger guys and sort of say, right, you know, buck your ideas up now, this is how it works. We saw that video, didn't we, of Davy Russell, didn't he, when he was that in Ireland, telling the lads like that, you're not in a points point anymore. And don't get me wrong, jumps back to the Nico de Boinville, Declan Queely thing. I think anyone, no matter you know, how experienced you are is entitled to the start that you want. You know, just because you're a senior rider doesn't mean you should be given a golden highway or anything like that. But a lot of the jockeys who I spoke to at Kempton did say that just attitudes are changing, and sort of that old kind of respect for their seniors has gone out the window a bit. I wonder if that's factored into why they're just a bit messier these days. It's like every man for himself.
Yeah, I liked Ruby Walsh's idea. I remember ITV Racing said about a rolling start. I'm a harness racing fan. I've done work in the harness racing industry here. Obviously, they use rolling starts in that and the trotting.
Yeah.
Obviously, you can't apply that one directly to racing, but is there some way we could have done that? I don't know. It might be explored. Still, it might be the next stage if it doesn't go right at Cheltenham next year or during the season. So it feels like we're sort of in that, saying to the jockeys now and the people, come on, it's one of your final chances before something drastically is going to have to change here. Yes. So let's see. I'll put more faith in them. I'm sure they'll be given stern words before the Cheltenham, on the Monday of Cheltenham, or Tuesday morning of Cheltenham next year as well, about the start. So
when you have 25 runners in a handicap, though, it exactly only that. Takes one person to half think about doing something and another person follow what they're doing.
These are animals as well, aren't they? They're not F1 cars. In terms of animal, one horse might be really keen and bolt the start. That's just what happened.
No one's fault.
No,
yeah.
Exactly.
Precisely. We had an angry trainer talking this week, something we might often say. I spoke to Hugo Palmer a few days ago about a draw bonus being implemented at Chester. I was surprised to find that Hugo, bearing in mind his relationship to the track as retained trainer for Michael Owen's Manor House Stables, he wasn't aware of this initiative. He was quite angry. Let's deal with the bonus first, and then I'll deal with Hugo's grievances. So we all know Chester is an incredibly tight track, and often those drawn wider are at a disadvantage. Now, to combat that, officials at Chester are creating a bonus. So, for instance, on their July 25 meeting, when this is going to come into play, it's only for the 5 furlong races. Horses are going to receive, as well as their winnings, a correlating percentage bonus. So two races over 5 furlongs are worth 15 grand on the 25th. Winning prize is about 7 grand. If you're drawn 10, you will therefore receive 10%, which is about 700 quid here, give or take a few. If you're drawn 9, you divide it by 9, etc., etc. So quite an interesting idea to implement to try and create some fairness. They want to try and keep the field sizes up. Just this idea in isolation, folks, do you think it's a good idea? Do you think it's enough money to make a difference? Obviously, not all races are going to be worth 15 grand. Go to you first, Matt.
Yeah, I like trying to be innovative with changes, but I'm almost in the case of, why don't you just put the prize, a little bit extra prize money into the races to keep people incentivized, even if they are drawn. I go, actually, oh, this handicap's worth whatever, 40 grand, 50 grand, maybe a class 3 or whatever. We'll still roll the dice with it. I think that might work a bit better than sort of this draw. I don't know. I'd feel aggrieved if I was an owner and I was drawn in sort of like 4 or 5 or whatnot, 6, and you might not be getting the incentive that someone in stall 10, 11 or 12 might get. It's just...
Do you not think that's fair, though? I mean, when I spoke to Hugo, he was saying if you draw wider than 5 in a 5 furlong sprint, you can basically just forget it.
You can, but sometimes the sport is about the luck and the unluckiness of the draw. I just think I'd like to see prize money levels go increase across the board, but that's a more deeper conversation for, you know, with the levy reform in the future and whatnot, and what headwinds the sports are facing. I'm okay with them trialing it, but I don't know if it's going to get really off the ground. It is frustrating at Chester when you are on the morning, you are refreshing racing admin for non-runners and it says, so this is a non-runner, and they might be a non-runner for legitimate reasons, but a lot of the times you see the correlation that they are drawn high. It is frustrating, and you aren't getting your value as a punter there. So I can understand why they're trying to do it there to keep the field high.
And you're giving something back to the owners who are, you know,
giving
their horses in.
Yeah, it's not a lot, though, is it?
Not if you're racing for 15 grand, which is Hugo's point.
Yeah, all right, I understand, you know, so many times we do preview calls for, you know, the May meeting or whatever, and you speak to a trainer and they'll say, you know, horse in great form, you know, all that as you'd expect, but we're drawn in wherever, we're drawn, you know, and it's like, well, they're kind of writing the sort of the
story,
the chances out already. So, but I mean, as Matt said, like, I don't think this would this story would be as much of a problem if they just increased the prize money. I mean, I know we're going to get on to what Hugo said in a moment, but it's just a recurring theme with not just Chester, but, you know, across the board, really. I mean, these owners, you know, they put a lot into the game, and sometimes they're getting rewarded with absolute peanuts. It's reflective of where kind of the sport is going at the moment. You know, they might travel hundreds of miles to see their horse run, and the horse could be running for, you know, 2-3 grand, 4 grand, or 7 in this case. So I think that's the main thing that needs to be addressed first before you start handing out bonuses that are basically just like a round of applause almost, little.
Okay. Hugo was saying that he was having a look at the card and said one of these £15,000 races, the horses running in it were capped at 85. That's pretty high caliber of horse to be running for essentially a 7 grand pot. And there's another race on the same card for Royal Ascot caliber horses worth 30 grand, i.e. 15 grand to the winner. He was saying in the middle of summer on a big race day, that's just not good enough. He said it was an absolute disgrace and that Chester should hang their heads in shame about it, especially when you consider that Goodwood's round the corner and you're going to have sprinters running for 100 grand quite easily. It's understandable to see why he would get worked up about it. And, you know, that's going to create an explosion, I guess, because he's one of their biggest trainers. He probably has more runners there than any other trainer. He said, we don't take our horses out if they're drawn badly. And one of the pertinent points he made was that, well, how many people are going to be winning this bonus anyway? You know, it might mean that they get bigger fields, but how many of them are going to be winning from 9, 10, 11 anyway? Which I thought was a pretty interesting point. He also made the point that Chester are doing pretty well financially from where he's standing. The crowds are up. He reckons they're raking it in from their media rights, and that this is just not good enough. Personally, I find it very hard to disagree with him.
Yeah, I mean, I completely, yeah, absolutely. I was more surprised that he was the one to come out and say it, you know, given the relationship he has with Chester and Michael Owen. And I know they love sending horses to that track. It's the local track. But, I mean, if he's kind of banging the drum first, then I'd imagine others will follow. Like you mentioned there, why would he run a horse rated in the 80s, 90s for 15 grand first prize when he could, you know, all right, albeit travel a lot further down south to Goodwood, where he could be running for 100 grand. You know, as an owner, the horse that Hugo might be running that he might take Chester might have a better chance of winning at Chester than it will Goodwood. But you want to be, as an owner, you want to be there on the big days. And if you're saying, would you rather go to Chester for possibly winning 15 grand, or would you want to go to Glorious Goodwood? Going to be on ITV. As an owner, it's a no-brainer. It's all about making money in this game if you want to stay afloat. And I think he's hit the nail on the head, really.
Yeah, I was staggered when interviewing that he wasn't consulted about it. That was my first surprise. I thought he'd have been involved in these conversations. But anyway, good for Chester for at least trying something new, I suppose. Do you think it will impact the draw much? Let us know. Moving on, quite a few farewells this week. We had Joe Fanning announcing his retirement on the flat. Henry Brooks had a torrid old time with injuries. He's announced his retirement. We had Rebel's Romance, who we saw recently at the July meeting winning. He's no longer going to be in action on the track. And also Hewick as well, a hugely popular jumps horse King George winner from a few years ago, bowing out. So lots of goodbyes to make, Matt. Joe Fanning, as someone who's based up north, he'd be incredibly familiar with his riding style, his relationship with the Johnsons, etc. over the years. Had some health concerns in recent years. Great to know that he's on the mend from those. But what an incredible career he's had.
Absolutely stellar and a stunning career, and hugely underappreciated, really. Not only because he's based in the north, and whenever I was at a meeting, you can actually bank your bottom dollar that he'd ride a winner, and it'd usually be for the Johnstons. But maybe because his riding style wasn't not pretty at all. It was very simplistic, and that's a compliment. From the front, or just selling behind, let the horse get into the room, and he just does the job. He's an absolute no-nonsense jockey who's one of the very, very best the North's ever produced. And he was just, I'm so glad that in his career we got those Group 1 wins on the last line of the Middle Park and the big one on subjectivist in the Ascot Gold Cup, which was, I thought, an unbelievable ride, 2021, wasn't it? And it's great that he's retiring at the age, I think he's in his 50s, but he's on his own terms as well. You know, a lot of jockeys, unfortunately, have not been able to say that before. Obviously, God bless Graham Lee at the moment in the North as well. So look, happy retirement to him, sensible decision. He's not going to be out of racing completely. It's just going to be the sort of the end of an absolute era. Those Charlie and Mark Johnson horses ridden by Jay Fanning going from the front and not being caught was a staple, not only the Northern tracks, but down south, Goodwood, they did really well at, for example. So, yeah, end of an era with Joe. And with Henry, it's just been rotten luck, hasn't it? He's had some incredibly serious injuries. And look, I know he's got a leg break at the moment, but it's not the reason why he's retired. It's due to the doctors about the former neck injuries. But it's nice to know that, and he's right, it was the disappointment there, but not disheartened, the sensibleness behind it. I know he's got a successful business outside of racing now, so it's good that he's almost, not retired, especially on his own terms, but sort of halfway to that, rather than him being in a hospital and being told he can't ride again, or even worse than that. So end of an era in the North, if in both flat and jumps, just to be there'll be big misses.
Yeah, very, very well said. And some horses who are still with us, but not going to be on the track anymore, Liam. Rebels Romance was one of my favourites. 9-time Group Grade 1 winner all over the world, whether it was Hong Kong, Dubai, America, Germany. Just an absolute star on the global stage. Gained legions of fans over the last couple of years for what he did. I just don't think you can quantify really how difficult it is to have a horse like that continue to perform at the highest level in all sorts of different ground conditions, track configurations. You know, the air miles he racked up were incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was in Qatar a few years ago and he was there and he won the Emir Trophy as well.
So reliable.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, you just know what you're going to get. And I think it's the attitude that he's shown throughout the career, and the willingness to want to race and want to win. And I'm sure William Buett will be one of the first to say what a superstar he's been. I just think also sometimes, you know, you see these Globetrotters winning outside of Britain. It kind of goes under the radar a little bit, you know, certainly in races like Germany that we might not see on the TV every day kind of thing. But he's gone on, done all that, but then he's come back to Britain and done it on the track in Britain as well, just to confirm his superstar status.
Yeah.
And I think that just shows, I think it's a credit to Godolphin, to Charlie Appleby and Buick. I just think the levels of consistency he's shown just shows what a top-class horse he's been.
Yeah, and he had that Hardwick Stakes win, didn't he? That was an important one for the Godolphin team last year, I think it was. And nice that he could bow out at his home track in Newmarket. What about the 800 quid horse, Hewick? The horse who went into a bar, won that incredible King George Galway Plates, went out to America and won, didn't he? For Shark Hanlon and their team, he was an incredible horse. I don't think we'll see anything like that in a long, long time.
No, I mean, just for the, we bang on about the price of the horse. I think he cost €800 or something like that. And obviously, he won the King George. And, you know, there was that video of him going into a horse walking into a bar. It sounds like at the start of a joke, doesn't it, really? But the video of him, I just think an incredible story. And it'll be a sore miss for the Hanlon team, you know. I know Paddy's coming through now with Paul Nichols. He's obviously ridden him a few times, but I guess he would almost feel like Hewick's sort of part of the family kind of thing, the way that he's been doing it for all these years. So, yeah, a fantastic career, and sad to see him go, but it's great to see him go out, you know, fit and healthy.
And it's great that we have an example to prospective owners that, you know, you don't have to be a millionaire and you can get involved, albeit there aren't Hewicks that come along every day, unfortunately. Safe retirement to all those we just mentioned. Before we go, we're going to have a final talk about the King George coming up on Saturday at Ascot. We had confirmations before we came in here. Let's talk about some of the key players. The betting is as follows: 7-4 Calandagan, 5-2 Benvenuto Cellini, 100-30 Masquerade Ball, the Japanese Raider, 8 Goliath and Calpan, and 12 Mini Hawk. As an international racing fan, Matt, I'm very, very excited to see Masquerade Ball coming over. Wurttemberg, another Japanese Raider, is going to be in there as well. Do you think that anyone can challenge Calandagan, the king of the world, in the middle distance division?
He's such a hard one because I love Calandagan as a horse. I love Benvenuto Cellini as a horse. And I've said it after Chester Mimi, and I think he might win the Breeders' Cup Turf.
Yes, I remember.
I got a bit of heat for that, but it looked on the like such a bad shout.
Going to plan now.
At the moment. I love Minnie Hawk as well. I think she's absolutely overpriced in the race, given what she did. She ran a fine race behind Ombudsman. I thought she's not a mile and a quarter horse either, and I know she had excuses and she disappointed in the Breeders' Cup Turf, but this time last year we were talking about her as the next superstar filly, and I think largely she doesn't deserve to have her wings clipped a little bit. I thought she ran a storm behind Ombudsman, the best horse in the world, joint best horse in the world with Kying Rising at Royal Ascot over a trip. I don't think she excels at necessarily, so it's an absolutely stellar race, and for all we talked about the headwinds British racing faces, prize money problems, etc., etc., some places are obviously doing it right to attract the Japanese runners, and a high profile one in Masquerade Ball as well, and Calandagan, who is just an absolute icon of the global turf scene at the moment as well. It's going to be an absolute cracker, and obviously the cliche is it's the summertime arc is what they call it, or the British arc as well. It's really living up to the sort of that billing this year, but I do think Minnie Hawk could run a stormer, even if Ryan Moore's riding Benvenuto Cellini.
Yeah, do you think he will ride Benvenuto?
I think the betting suggests yes.
I'm quite surprised. I mean, I know Tom Siegel price-wise put up Minnie Hawk anti-post, and she's a much bigger price now. I'm with you. I think 12-1 is a decent price. I think mile and a half is her trip. I think she's probably going to be peaking at the right time. This will be the race that they've got her cherry ripe for, but I guess it does make you second guess with the colt being...
There's also things where it's not felt for a while that Aidan O'Brien and Ballydoll have had the rub of the green in the King George as well, in a way. And the form of some of his runners at the Curragh at the weekend was a little bit left to be desired ahead of a big few weeks at Ascot, Goodwood and Galway.
I'm going to see Masquerade Ball and Burtonberg on Wednesday in Newmarket. They're doing a gallop, so maybe I'll keep my powder dry until then. But I think he should have beat Romantic Warrior when he was last seen at Charlton. I think he's going to be a real big threat. Liam, who are you siding with?
Yeah, again, you can make a very good case for Minnie Hawk, and I do think she is. I think there's certainly value in her price. Given, I think she is better over a mile and a half than a mile and a quarter. Calandagan obviously won the St. Cloud race that he won 12 months ago before going on to win this King George. I do think it's a hotter race this year, and rightly so. I know Ascot, obviously it's now worth 2 million, that it's the richest race in Britain, so with that comes, you know, you expect them to have international interest just as much as interest in Britain and Ireland. Calandagan, I think he's worth taking on at the prices. I mean, obviously it was great to see him back to winning ways, and I thought he was fantastic in the race last year when beating Kelpana. But I think Francis Graffa's got another live chance in Goliath. I just think...
Won the race before?
Yeah, I just think, you know, wasn't far behind, I think it was Giovalotto in the Hardwick, will relish quick conditions and proven himself on the track, like you said, won the race. And I just think I think he is around 14-1. I think there's really good value in his price. So I think he can run a big race.
He's talking about fan favourites and Hewick, etc. with his string hole. He's going to be a big attraction for many, I'm sure. Great to see him back at the highest level. What a fantastic show we've had. Thanks so much for joining us. Let us know your thoughts in the comments down below, and we'll see you again in a week's time. All the best.